we mentioned before, the Gita uses the word yoga in at least 150 different ways throughout the text. So the verbal root that holds all of this together is this in Sanskrit. It's yuj. And it does, in fact, take you to the English word union and to the word yoke. And so even the most kind of cursory internet pursuit of the word yoga is going to go to union, and it's going to go from there very quickly to oneness or singularity. When in fact, the original sense of the word, that proclivity shows you two things about the things you learn on the internet. The first is that whoever imposes the structural bias first carries the day. So the first thing to notice is that everybody is repeating everybody else because nobody stopped to think about this or to study the subject any more thoroughly. So just because the first 9 entries in Google give you the same answer, no matter what the subject is, be suspect, because people simply because that's what a meme is. Does everyone know that word? It's a word that was created by the great Richard Dawkins of neo-Darwinism fame, actually. And it's meant to imitate and spoof and tell us something about the word gene. And what it means is self-replicating. It means a phrase or an idea that ingratiates itself into consciousness. I need to tell you guys what a meme is, but you do need to know that it's not just it's an invented idea, and it's an invented idea because the ideas end up functioning autonomously. That's the thing about a meme, is that it doesn't matter who made it up. As soon as it survives in iteration, it works just like natural selection. It can become its own thing. It carries on. It goes forward without attribution or ideas, and so it is always sort of interesting to figure out who figured things out. There's a way in which there's a particular part of the subject of Hinduism that I started with a million years ago, where the way I describe how it happens is now a meme. Like, no one even quotes me anymore. It's just sort of standard procedure. It exists. I'm not looking for credit or not credit. I'm just trying to say it can happen to anyone. You don't have to be smart or famous. You can just, all that has to happen is that things self-replicate. It's that arbitrary an idea. So the first point is careful. Right? This is another reason I want to keep you off the internet. But the second idea is that there is a structural interpretive bias to this material. That is, whoever has laid claim to it and then gets their opinion out there first in such a way, owns the subject. And the people who, and one of the things that makes the Gita so interesting as a work is that it kind of turns in two dramatically different directions. It turns first towards this oneness meme, which is where yoga is going to take you. And that's a kind of reductive perennialist idea. It's reductive because it's trying to argue throughout that Krishna's fundamental case is for a world that's not only in which everything is connected to everything, but everything is quite simply a universe, quite simply him. The first way the yoga union meme works is all universe Krishna, like that. And it essentially just makes a straight up identity claim. Okay? So, and that becomes a kind of convenient way of saying that all roads lead literally to the same thing. That is a kind of carryover from early Upanishadic claims and so this first side of it isn't monotheism, it's monism. Right? Monotheism is one God. Monism is oneness. Right? And so the first kind of dominant understanding of yoga and read through the Gita, which is rather remarkable, is a monism meme in which there's a kind of equation that pushes through it and says, well, in fact, it all kind of reduces and arrives at the same place. The second sort of way the Gita is taken
is not in a mono, is towards what we might call a new synthesis, and that's not particularly my term, towards a monotheism, which is itself an extraordinary act for Hindus, because all monotheisms in Hinduism are what we call henotheisms. And all henotheisms are, in some measure or another, panentheisms. Let's just make this equation pretty simple, because these are very helpful terms once we understand what they're talking about. Monotheism is the idea that there is one God, and presumably, and this is kind of where it stands in contrast to the union kind of monism meme, is that there is a particular intelligent agency autonomously functioning inside the creative matrix. Let me say that again. I just want you to think about it. There's an autonomous agency, God, who has power and authority inside the matrix of creation. Exactly how it exists with respect to the matrix of creation is further worked out when we work out our point here. Henotheism is another word that was coined in the history of religions by folks studying Hinduism. And it really came out of the old Vedic view. Henotheism is the idea that you can have many gods, or you can talk about God in many ways, but every time you mention a particular god, they stand for your idea of God. So when the Veda talks about Indra, all the Indra hymns say, you're the baddest, you're the biggest, you're the real guy. Then go to Rudra, you get the same thing. Go to Vishnu, you get the same thing. In other words, whatever God is given forefront, whatever name is used, whatever personality is invoked, they're not diminishing the differences in personality. They're saying each one of them represents that singular principle of monotheism, that is, the intelligent creative agency that holds a kind of superior function. So henotheism is the idea that whatever God you choose is the superior God. And if you notice, Western monotheism, until you get to 2nd Isaiah, is built on the same model. Right? The Decalogue, that's the Ten Commandments, right? That says, thou shalt have no other gods before me, presumes there are other gods. Like, why else is it phrased that way, right? So it's just saying our God is better than your God. Our God's the real God, not your God. The idea that there is only one God, that happens relatively late in the Bible, and arguably it never happens for the Hindus because of henotheism. Because they're quite willing, because not only are they going to be willing to talk about Krishna this way, Krishna's going to identify himself with the Vedic sacrifice, with the yajna. He's going to say, I'm that. He's going to give us a whole chapter 10 in which he kind of points out the deeper underlying archetypes and their relationship to instantiation and manifestation. You know, of mountains, I am Himalaya. Of rivers, I am the Ganga. Of cars, I am Porsche. You know, like that. He's going to go through. No one ever laughs at that joke anymore. So maybe I use it too many times. Like, whatever your favorite thing is, whatever you think is the thing that exemplifies and manages to define all other things that are like it. So it's an archetype to resemblance theory, which is really a way of saying all of this, in some sense, is part of us. Now, panentheism is a kind of turn it can coexist with monotheism. Panentheism is, but it solves a problem, again, that's endemic to Western religions, but not generally speaking to the Hindus. Okay, in Western religions, the monotheistic creative agency, right, the God, is not the creator, is not to be confused with creation. All three Western monotheisms are going to have to figure out how to make that case, but that's their case. There is no other case that they make. The most diehard mystical union person, whether we're at St. John of the Cross or Catherine of Siena, or it doesn't really matter where we look in Christianity. You go to the Ibn al-Haq in Islam, right? Al-Haq is the name. It's actually onomatopoetic for the sound of, apparently, the sound of the guillotine taking off his head for him being so heretically Muslim by saying, you know, really God is everything. Islam didn't really like that, Orthodox Islam. Why? Because creator is not to be confused with creation. That's a simple 101 problem to think about, right? Jewish tradition has to kind of go, and they all have to solve that problem. How does this agency that has hegemony and authority and power over the creation get itself back into creation? The first claim is it does. It tells us it's there. That's what Western scripture does. It goes, I'm God and you're not, and I'm this thing that exists and you're not. And then you have to get the breakthrough moments, like he has to like drop tablets on Moses. He's going to have prophets. He's going to have burning bushes. He's going to have divided seas. But some way or another, God's got to show up in the world. That's the problem that they're solving, right? Christianity has that weird incarnation theory, you know, like there's this guy who came, right? Islam goes back to the earlier model of law and declaration through a prophet, right? But that's what they're solving. Now, panentheism makes all of that problem go away. Because panentheism does this. It says creator equals creation plus one. That is, the creator is the creation, but the creator, the agency, has some kind of peculiar autonomous intelligence that's able to act inside the matrix. One might say, independently of the matrix, but is still no different than the matrix. So again, a basic panentheistic analogy is a spider in a web, right? I mean, the web is nothing but spideriness. The web is the spider in a certain way, except the spider in some sense has a kind of agency over the web that is different than the web itself. This is the kind of thing Hindus argue about. What they don't have, they don't have a monotheism that really goes, there's only one God and he's not creation. You kind of want to say what I just said isn't true, because somewhere along the line, some Hindu will say that, okay? Like, the only two things to ever know about Hindus is that never and always are words you should use never and always, right? It's just too diverse. It's too big a subject. It's like other religions are a solar system, and these are billions of galaxies. There's that much weird, wonderful diversity in this conversation. And there's no agreement. Even what's even more fun is that you'll find historical commentators espousing a particular Siddhanta, a particular kind of interpretive point of view, say on the Bhagavad Gita, and then there'll be a sub-commentary written by that guy's legacy, like either his direct student or someone a couple centuries later, and they're supposed to be exactly on, like, kind of, they're sort of, in some sense, they represent the same church, and they never agree. They never agree. Why would you write another commentary if the only thing you had to do was to agree? There's no party line that ever withstands the argument. That's what's so interesting. Although they're all kind of happy to create some or another party line. That's what they do. Okay, so they get away, they kind of get us out of the problems of monotheism, because panentheism gets God back into the world. See, so they're not solving the Western problem anymore. And henotheism is going to be something that Krishna tacitly endorses. He's going to say, I am the Brahman of the Upanishad. I am the self that they're talking about. I am the Vedic ritual, the yajna that our ancestors talked about. Like, I'm the core of that. And then, of course, he's going to argue, and we'll go further into what this means as we go through the day, he's going to argue, but I am, me, Krishna, I am a particular and peculiar way in which all of that intelligence and power, authority and autonomy has relocated itself in just me. And by the way, I'm standing here talking to you, and yes, I am your brother-in-law, and I am the charioteer here, and I'm all of those things too. So identifying himself even as mortal doesn't diminish his agency as a god or even his immortality as a being. Furthermore, he's also going to argue that the immortality that he tells you he is, you also possess. So you begin to question this very sort of, been raising a much more interesting question, which is, if God is everything, creator and creation, if God has an autonomous agency and a power over the world, if the essence of that divinity is also pervasive, suffusive, it's in everything, and by the way, it's your own very nature, then what makes God God and you not God? that becomes a, like, in other words, the line between us is really very thin. And one of the things that Krishna is going to do is he's going to argue, well, if you really, there's sort of lots of strategies that come out of that. But one of them is, if you really knew who you were, you really could just do the things I do. Why not? And then the other side of the argument is, well, you share my essential nature, but you really just can't do the things that I do. Because, you know, because I can and you can't. And so God has a kind of virtuosity over the create the matrix that you don't have. You know, he's Eddie Merckx and Wayne Gretzky and Simone Biles all in one character. Like, you go, oh yeah, I do gymnastics or I play soccer, but like not like that, right? And so is he arguing, and here's really where the point comes down. Are they arguing that he is different in kind, or are they arguing that he is different in degree? See the difference? Western monotheisms are built fundamentally on the claim that the divine is different in kind, not in degree. Think about it. It's a qualitative difference, not a quantitative difference. Hurting this morning. So the argument here begins, and here's the interesting piece. So I started with, you look up the word yoga, and you're going to get two kind of, if you did, please don't, just study the text. You'll get two radically, dramatically kind of divergent memes. The one is to say, really, Krishna is just another way to talk about oneness, and yoga's purpose is to take you to that singular, to return you to that singularity. And so not only, so the meme, the claim, the metaphysics, right, couples with a method. The method that is yoga says, we can get you back, footprints in the snow, from difference, diversity, ignorance, misconception, maya, illusion, more than one thing seems to be true. We can trace you back to the singularity from which you originated. That put in 21st century physics terms is not an insane idea. Like, if you just had enough information, you could get back to the singularity. It doesn't take seriously, and this is kind of where the Krishna synthesis starts to make even more sense in 21st century terms, is that one of the things the physics folks tell us now is that you can't do that. That actually, between oneness and where we are today, things have actually really changed. That is, what's here now wasn't there before. Does everybody understand what I mean by that? Even evolutionary biology coincides with physics on this point. Take it to heart. It's an important point. Almost everything that it takes to be human on the periodic table is not traceable back to the origins of the universe. We need black holes. We need more energy. We need more energy to make the elements that we need to just be living beings than were there at the beginning. This is all kind of mathematically pulled out. So in some sense, the monism argument from a 21st century point of view is a bit spurious. We may trace ourselves to a singularity, we came from a singularity, but we can't get back to the singularity. The monism arguments are, you can, yoga is how you do it. There's a core, there's an essential claim. Find the proper footprints in the snow, learn how to walk, that is, learn how to meditate, learn how to comprehend, learn how to act, know what you're committing to, and you can find your way back to the singularity. The more complicated argument, which is really closer to what the Gita seems to be saying, is that indeed there was a singularity. Indeed that singularity possesses within its own potency the capacities of intelligence that are re-represented in your intelligence. In other words, the Gita's argument is solving what today in the 21st century we call the hard problem of consciousness problem, right? The hard problem of consciousness is how did consciousness emerge from unconsciousness? And when it does, is there a line between the two? Do you want me to say that again? That is consciousness the result of materiality, or is consciousness a principle that somehow inhabits the universe because there's a difference between unconscious and conscious things? And we know that there are. At least that's the claim.
Go ahead. One more time. Okay, so I want you to think about the hard problem of consciousness, and let's make it two simple things. The first is, how does consciousness emerge from the unconscious? Right? You look out at the deep, dark space and rock and gaseous elements, and somehow RNA turns into DNA. Next thing you know, recursion, life, WTF. How did we get from an unconscious material world to a conscious world? Point two. Does consciousness precede or inhabit the unconscious as its own principle? Does everyone understand why what Darwin said upset the church so much? Upset Christianity's most fundamental claim? Okay, let's make sure you understand this, because no one ever teaches you this in school, because religion doesn't want you to know this, right? That is, the ethos of religion doesn't want you to think too much about this. Okay? If we are the products of a process of natural selection, leaving aside that that's blind, pitiless, purposeless, methodless, and never has a future in mind, right? There's no point to it. It's not trying to do anything. It just does what it does. Leaving aside that idea, right? We are a product of a process, right? Monotheism, or even God agency, the way Krishna's portraying it in the Gita, is the notion that before natural selection, there is a being that came, that wasn't a product of natural selection. That's the key rub. You see? Because we don't know any living beings that aren't the product of natural selection. So it's just a claim. But the problem, and then you'll find, I had a colleague who once thought this. I thought this was the most ridiculous thing I had ever heard. He said, well, there's a God, and God made natural selection. And I went, wait a second. God made a process, but isn't created by the process. He says, yes. I go, that's a nifty idea, since there is nothing that we know that's conscious that isn't made by the process. So that's not a proof. It's just a claim. And it's a claim that defies everything else we know about the process, which is that every living thing comes from the process itself, right? Now, Krishna never argues that he doesn't come from the process. He argues just that he was there from the beginning. So it's a kind of interesting argument. And the reason that they can get away with this, and this makes it also kind of interesting, is that the process is so recurrent, it's so repetitive, that the previous iterations of the universe selected out. So you could even argue that the universe in its singularity created Krishna before the rest of the process of natural selection created us, which is kind of backwards. But it's not insane to look out into the cosmos and to think that somewhere under the conditions of heat and light and energy and the principles of the universe, that there aren't beings that have evolved to more sophisticated forms of intelligence than ourselves. I mean, you don't have to be sort of listening to late night radio to think that that could happen, right? So, because it's been a really long time, and we're only kind of 2.8 billion out of it, and the whole thing's probably 12.8. There's been a lot more room for natural selection to do its business. But don't mistake this. Religion gets in trouble because it can't answer these questions. It doesn't have a plausible answer. And this is the only answer we've had. I mean, take it from the religion professor. The single most important idea of the last 200 years is natural selection. The most important idea that human beings have ever considered. Why? Because it's the only plausible description of why we're here at all. How we got here. Now, Hindus are like everybody else. In some sense, they're religion. They want to know how we got here. Part of the way the meme works is, on the one hand, it wants to say, well, you've always been here. It's always just been a singularity in its own recurrence. Like, it starts as one, it goes bang, sooner or later it reverts back to one, and lather, rinse, repeat. It's just a repetitive, recurrent process. The other argument, but that's not the argument the Gita particularly wants to make. Here, the argument is that suffusive, creative intelligence is not only there from the beginning and is its cause, it can, and here's the critical idea, it can intervene in this world.
and does. So one of the ironic features of this word, avatar is just the North Indian pronunciation. In North Indian vernacular languages, when a word ends in short A, it drops. So you get avatar, not avatar. You get Mahabharata, not Mahabharata. You get Ramayana, not Ramayana. So when you hear the extra A on the end, that's the Sanskrit word. That's ordinary. In deep South India, it gets even more fun because they go to an M on the end, so it'll be Ramayanam, Mahabharatam, like that. Like they'll add a stop after the Sanskrit letter. That's how you know like who's got their finger on it. And North Indian speakers, because their daughter languages like Hindi and Gujarati and Punjabi and Bengali are so close to Sanskrit, those are folks who almost invariably think they know Sanskrit because their mother tongue is so close to it. Not even close. They don't. They can recognize the words, but the words don't mean the same because they're used in different ways, in different contexts. These are genuinely different worlds. It's more complicated than it always appears, always. First rule of the Hindus. Every time you go, I got this, or there's only one of this, or this is how it goes, just say to yourself, nah. Like, we'll find some exception. So, and notice that this is the whole ethos of this argument is an argument against the uniqueness of a singular intelligence that isn't creation. The implicit argument throughout the Bhagavad Gita, no matter where you think Krishna, what you think he is or what he's doing, he is not an entity separate from creation. That's a no-fly zone for Hindus. Islam makes the best argument for that in the Western monotheisms. It says it's an inarguable point. Right? Islam is the one of the three Western monotheisms whose philosophers never argue for the existence of God. They're not, in a certain sense, they're not allowed. It's understood to be so self-evident that it's an inarguable case. Like, obviously, something had to make all of this, and the thing that made this isn't this. It's just that simple to them.
So if Krishna is a avatar, then how is he the monist solution as an avatar? Because then that would imply that there are other solutions.
Of course. There are other solutions for other ages, for other times, for other situations.
But even at that time, if he wasn't like an incarnation of like a set of like 10, then...
Yeah, well, you're going to find the set of 10 avatars is going to show up in your Love Song of the Dark Lord, which comes like the last piece, the last thing we're going to read. It mentions that Krishna's kind of the protagonist of that text, but it goes, but you know, I took 10 avatars. There are 10 specific ways in which the Vishnu idea breaks into the world. But it's just the idea that God's kind of like a cat burglar. Like he kind of sneaks into the world however he wants to do pretty much whatever he wants. Now, the argument in the Gita is that he tells you why he came into the world. He says, things have gone to a hell in a handbasket. I take form to scoop up the mess and churn it from the bottom and keep it going. He almost argues, I come to set it to rights, but that's really more of a Rama idea. Krishna's much more of a trickster, churner. Like he's here to toss everything up in the air and go, because if we just let the mess settle the way you've done it, that's going to make things worse. And almost all of the other avatars in the way they're described for Hindus, they're coming like to solve a particular problem. Like there's a particular demon or a particular kind of thing in the universe, and God goes, and the idea is that won't do. We must intervene. But think of avatar simply as the idea of intervention into regularity. Because Krishna also argues that for the law of karma. Karma is the idea of, one might say, flawless recursion. There's a reason for everything. Everything functions in causality. Everything follows a process of complex causality, so you don't need one cause for things. You can see that's a kind of a multiplex of causality creating effects. And the argument of karma is that everything is in perfect accountability. When someone in their deep emotional despair at a funeral or somewhere says to you, everything happens for a reason, this is a philosophical consolation. This is just there to make you feel good, right? Because in effect, the answer to that is karma, 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 karma. That's what they just said to you.
Because what they're saying is every action is fully accountable in a process of causal accountability. Now, if that were the case, now apply 21st century understandings of natural selection again, and causality, as the Gita is going to really interestingly intimate to us. If that were the case, things would have never changed. That is, we would have no experience of evolution. We would have no experience of real diversity. Why? Because the bacteria would have stayed bacteria, right? In other words, the system has to break. The system has to change. The system has to permit difference in recursion, right? The same thing can't happen exactly the same way every single time, because then there's no difference. So Krishna, in a sense, is the principle that in a world that must have recursion to be reliable, which of course is exactly what we do understand, right? There are pieces of the human genome that haven't changed in the better part of 2 billion years. Like, think about that. We've done that little talk before in here about how regular the world is. Natural selection doesn't mean arbitrary. It means exactly the opposite. It's trying to explain recursion. That is how things replace themselves with themselves, essentially flawlessly, and then why things break down. Entropy. He's got a theory of entropy. The whole Hindu theory of time is a theory of entropy. Right? When he talks about the four ages, we're in the fourth age. We're in the period of greatest entropy. So he's essentially arguing the universe started in less entropy and then goes through four kind of pivotal epochal moments. And that project of entropy, that is things moving from order to disorder, increases. And so when they call this Kali Yuga, the age of kind of haphazardness, what they're meaning is recursion is unreliable. But if recursion were too reliable, we would be stuck. Get it? Things couldn't change. So the system has to break. Part of what Krishna's arguing is that he's the one who does the breaking. That is, he's the principle itself, that recursion must fail. That is, there has to be some intervention, avatara, into perfect order for the world, in some sense, to become the world. And then the second half of that is, and then it gets to be such a mess that intervention, in some sense, sets things back to rights. Like it puts something else in the mix to simply allow viability to go on. He doesn't say he's going to make it better. He says he's going to make it continue. And that, in a sense, is a very modern argument, too, because, you know, whether we, you know, the dinosaurs were here a long time, they're not here anymore. The humans have had a fairly short tenure. We might be on the way out. But he's arguing life isn't on the way out. Just you. Right? But the very notion of avatara, if you think about it in a kind of a push, a kind of theological, mythic edge to a more sort of interesting way of conceiving what they're talking about. What are they talking about? They're talking about how the world has to be intervened, how the processes of karma must be intervened in. They must break down. They must alter. They must permit some kind of difference. Otherwise, things can't grow. They can't change. And since they obviously do, then avatara is obviously a part of the world. That is, mutation is avatara, would be another way of putting it. Spencer.
So is it saying that, like, God works through avatara to, like, break the system?
Yeah. Yeah, and the more you follow Krishna mythology, because you're going to see him in the Mahabharata, once we get past the Gita, in the larger context of the Mahabharata, then you're going to see him in the Love Song of the Dark Lord, and you're going to go, yeah. Like, one of the more interesting questions students ask when we come to this, at the end, especially at the end of Mahabharata, they go, I didn't know, like, God could lie, cheat, steal, be an assassin. And I go, well, why not? You have this idea of some sort of immaculate puppeteer, kind of pulling the strings. And that's not what they're talking about. They're talking about a kind of character who gets into the mess and in some sense makes it more messy and makes it right all at the same time. Somehow. But clearly, there are powers of intervention that we don't fully possess. And that's going to make Krishna not quite like you. That's why, like, when we're talking about genome and manipulating life and putting stuff in. And when people say play God, that's exactly what God does. God plays. When we get to the end of this Krishna story, and he's kind of the only god we spend any particular time with, that just happens to be a feature of how this course does its business. It's not particularly representative of the Hindus, who have perfectly happy to talk about any one of their 330 million gods all at the same time in different ways. But the basic idea is that interventionary principle of power is to be reckoned with. Like, that's the issue to take hold of. And it's not for better or for worse. It's for viability. It's for continuance. Because if it weren't that, then the very argument at the beginning of the Gita wouldn't make any sense either. He isn't telling Arjuna, it's great virtue and it's all going to work out fine and you should go kill your relatives. He's saying the alternative is catastrophe. The alternative is nihilism. The villains win. No. He isn't promising us it's going to get better. He's promising us that we have to act in ways that will allow it to carry on. Nihilism is not viability. Go ahead.
So, like, would the Hindus claim that Avatara is, like, natural selection, basically? Like, any time anything changes, it's, like, God playing, it's him intervening?
Right.
So any, like, mutation of
anything.
Any kind?
Right. Anything that implies difference makes a difference, because all that means is that perfection ceases. So God is perfect because God, in a certain sense, on the one hand, because karma does do that magical thing. Like, it's astonishing, right? That the features of the genome haven't changed in 2 point. Like, what else in your life replicates that perfectly? Right? Exactly. So on the one hand, they're saying, what's the divine? The divine is the capacity to be itself. What also is the divine? It's the capacity to change itself. When it's the capacity to be itself, it's called karma. And that's going to take you to a certain kind of mechanistic sense of determinism. You're going to end up where Rapula Rahula ended up in what the Buddha taught, that there is no free will or there is no choice, because karma can't be broken. It's just more, what Rahula argues is what some Hindus will argue. That is that you just don't have a big enough picture of karma. Like, everything really is accountable, you're just not good at it. But the alternative argument really kind of matches much more about what we really understand about the world. And it matches closer to, I think, to what Krishna's saying in the text, which is that, sure, I'm perfection, but I'm what causes perfection to change. So if you want to call that imperfection, that's perfect too. In other words, because mutation is part of the world. Brokenness is part of the world. So whatever is part of the world can't be said to be extraneous or wrong. Let's go further than that, because he's going to kind of take this to the project of ourselves. Look at chapter 16, for example, when he talks about ethics. It's a very peculiar kind of binary. But one of the things that you can read into this that's pretty plain to see is that he isn't telling you that fear, anger, jealousy, avarice, hatred are somehow wrong. In the sense of they don't really exist. He essentially argues they are mostly to your disadvantage. And so it's almost a natural selection argument. Think about it this way. If you weren't supposed to be afraid, why would it be still in the mix? It would select itself out. In other words, if it doesn't bring some reason for things to carry on, it wouldn't be there. Because viability is the point, not better. We don't have traits because they're good or bad. We have traits because they survive. So if these traits survive, similarly, you can turn them into assets or you can turn them into liabilities. The capacity to turn them into assets is very much his project. And when they are liabilities, he's going to call, especially in chapter 16, which is very late in the game, right? He's going to call those demonic. Why? Because they serve no better purpose for the greater project, which is to try to figure out how to go from this is how we survive to this is how we thrive. Now, if we thrive well enough, such as it is, then we can explore the more creative and imaginary features of being a more sensitive human being. We can enter art, we can enter philosophy, we can enter imagination, because that thriving part we've got pretty well down. Like, you know, there's food on the table and bridges get built, right? And so the argument of the Gita is literally Bhagavad. It is to be filled with a kind of deeper portion, a prosperity. Like he's saying, Bhaga means like to flourish, not just to survive and kind of thrive in a material way. Once you thrive in a material way, you're going to write me that postcard that says, what the hell was I thinking? All I did in college was figure out how to thrive in a material way. Now what does life mean? And I'm going to say, well, first, if you can ask that question, you really did thrive, right? Because you're not just freaked out about your rice bowl every day. Like, you're not just trying to survive and get along. So it's a fantastically bourgeois privilege to be able to create meaning in your life, but you know what? You're going to want it. And that's and what he says is, what's meaning? Well, meaning is to be able to sing, literally, Gita, the song of your own Bhagavat, that is being possessed of good fortune. Like, what is a good fortunate life? Sing that story. The title tells you the thesis of the book. Okay, let's bear down to some particulars to understand what goes on next. So last time we talked about how karma yoga does its business, right? And karma yoga is the idea that there's actions in the world and then there's our application to action. That's the yoga part. So the first thing he wants us to understand is what the nature of actions are like. And we talked about that at length last time, right? There are obligatory actions. Then there are occasional actions, which are really just another species of the obligatory ones. Like, events happen and you got to show up. Those are the so the nitya ones are the obligatory ones. The naimittika ones are the occasional ones. And then he says, and then everything else falls into the category of the kinds of actions that serve your interests, your preferences, your desires, the kamya karmas, right? And he says, beware of those. At best, he says, beware. You can read the text. Don't do those. That does seem kind of ridiculous to think that you're not, like, you're here to flourish, but you're not here to have anything you want. That's where the text doesn't, like, that's where that reading of the text doesn't hold up well. So where it does hold up well is beware. Because everything you want implicates everyone else too. And by the way, your preferences aren't necessarily other people's preferences, nor are they superior just because they're your preferences. So what would make actions driven by desire better than other actions? How would you know the difference? How do you sort out the actions of desire such that you can have some criteria to investigate, to ask yourself, how would I know this is a good idea? Like, how would I know this act is legitimized? How would I know this act is valuable? How do I know that my desires don't create a worse situation? How do I get to Bhagavad? How do I get to its really swell good fortune in this kind of action? Well, he gets two kinds out of the story right away. He says those obligatory and inevitable ones. Don't argue with that. Don't fuss about it. Do it. Move on. The same thing with the occasional ones. Because there's an urgency. You don't have time to be screwing around with things that are inarguable. So then the question does turn to what makes your preferential actions legitimate? And the answer he gives is that is this complicated thing that we've also discussed at some length, but let's summarize it so we understand it. Right? What makes your preferential actions, your desired actions, your kamya karmas legitimate, if they are legitimate at all? And he says, and his argument is, when the outcomes effectively redound to something greater than yourself, and when they are not the object you pursue. So he gives us two simple criteria. He says, if you're in search of the outcomes, that's a good bet that your desired actions are going to miss the mark. Because there's not enough principle. There's not enough care to the act itself. You're preoccupied with what he calls the fruits of the actions. And he says, that's going to be a bad idea because you're going to lose the plot. You're going to lose perspective. You're not going to evaluate the action. You're just going to be thinking, I'm doing this to get that. So do this to get that, and when you spend your time thinking about the that you're going to get, invariably sends you off your marks. But the second argument is even more interesting, right? It's that it isn't so bad to have outcomes or to want the outcomes it's first pay attention and you'll get outcomes. But the second argument is, but those outcomes implicate all kinds of things more than yourself. It's a kind of butterfly argument, like you do this little thing over here and all that stuff over there happens. He's essentially arguing that action entangles you, right? And it entangles you in ways that entangle you in ways you don't even understand for yourself. Like, you're going to make a bigger mess for yourself unless you disentangle what you're doing. That disentanglement he's going to postpone, we'll talk about that in 1 minute, because to disentangle yourself is going to require knowledge. But we're still on action. So how do you disentangle action? Well, you make sure that it that first you understand it implicates more than yourself, and then in some sense, it serves more than yourself. His argument is that selfish action is reductive. That's a bad scene. Don't end up there, right? So how do you disentangle yourself from the idea that all actions have greater implications and greater sensibilities than you're aware of? Like, every time you go, I want, you're inviting some kind of predicament, some kind of deeper trouble for yourself. Pause on that. He's going to have a next solution to that. But before he gets there, he says, the easier way to think about this is you're not alone in this. The Gita's argument is ironic. It wants to take you to the essence of things, and it wants to argue that alienation, separation, selfishness is the problem. So the closer you are to your core, the less separated you feel. Just like, ironically, and we said this last time, the more capably indifferent you are, that is, the more emotionally observant you are of your state, the more sensitive you are to the world. It's a really interesting argument, right? In other words, he's saying the more chill you are, the more you feel. That's a pretty interesting strategy. But that's why he thinks he has to teach it. And he thinks that you don't know how to do that. You don't know how, in some sense, to cultivate what he calls disinterest. He has a word for that. It's called vairagya. The word raga is just another one of those words that mean passion, desire, feeling, right? Vairagya would mean bereft of. Vairagya would mean being in the state of having some perspective on your passion. So it's not non-interest, it's not uninterested, it's disinterest. In the sense that it's a bit like going to the hearings this morning. You have to think that there are things like facts, and then whatever you want or your partisan views are another matter. But you gotta go, here's the call as best as we can make it. That's disinterest. And then he says, when you arrive at that place where you can receive and absorb and penetrate the facts, then what can happen? Well, then you re-engage your emotions. Because then you can say, oh, this is right from wrong, or this is how I feel about it. But he doesn't want you to make your feelings or your connections until, in some sense, you have this perspective. You have this vision. The first piece was you're entangled in yourself, you're going to be a mess. The second piece, so we had to figure that out. That is, everything you do that involves I want complicates your life in ways you can't even imagine. But you can, so we'll figure that out. Point two, everything you do implicates, involves, suggests somebody else is involved. Think about more than yourself, and you have the first great perspective of karma yoga. Okay, so now we're in this malaise where we do want things, and every time we say that, it implicates us in a greater notion. He's going to give us the next yoga for that. That's going to be jnana yoga, the yoga of knowledge. And so his argument is really first this simple. Your desires raise the question, who are you? Who can you be? Who could you be? Let's go through it simply, right? Your desires implicate you in three questions. Who are you? Who are you? And he's going to give a metaphysical answer. He's going to give an answer from karma, like you were born in this body, this time, this age, right? I usually call that the walk through the cemetery moment. Like, you go, oh, all these people had their time. Like, this was their age. This is who they, this we take Professor Homerin's course and find out who the speaking stones are, right? These people all had wives, right? So who are, and then, but then who are you is also the pursuit of self, of what that metaphysical essence that he talks about as being is. It implicates every part of who are you is something you have to take seriously from the most abstract metaphysics to ancestry.com. Like, how did you come out? What confluence of recessive genes made you a ginger? Right? That being, see what I mean? Like, that you're asking, who are you? Who can you be? Puts you in circumstances of history, of culture, of society. But it also implicates your yoga. Like, are you determined? Do you care? Do you want to do the work? Who can you be? That's going to make you ask, he wants your yoga to work to your boundary, to your limits. He isn't telling you to extend, he isn't telling you to go 110%. He's just telling you to get to 100. Why? Because who you can be is an underutilized resource, principal fission of the text. The things you can do, you're probably not doing. Hindus have a real issue with indolence. They think mostly we're pretty lazy. And then that's why their first prescription is dharma. Their first prescription is show up. Like, show up and do the thing you're supposed to do, then carry on. So they don't like indolence. They like a kind of urgency to the moment, and they think that you're underutilized. But who could you be? That project of creative imagination, that's the Bhagavan. That's the possessed of the better part. That's the true objective here. Who could you be? That's an act where, and then whether you arrive at that or not, creating that line tangential to the circle of self, that's the project of becoming human. It's a project of imagination, of creativity, of artistry. And notice how kind of interestingly he poses it. His first case in Jnana Yoga is know what the world is. Like what it is, how you turned up in it, how you need to receive it. Like, figure out the world. That is, take all your STEM courses. Like, figure out the world. Then ask yourself, we know now what it is and what it can be. Now, what do we want it to be? What could it be? And that then implicates the text and implicates knowledge in a moral commitment or in a deeper personal commitment. The assumption here is you do your duty, you flourish in your work, right? And then you have to, in some sense, commit to a creative endeavor. You have to figure out the thing that you want to be. That when you say, who could I be? You then have to have a yoga. That is, you have to say, I'm gonna find out who I am by reading literature or writing poetry or fixing bicycles or making furniture or in other words, you've got to find something you want to do. Because that's the better part of living. So once you have the knowledge issue down, he comes to the last yoga. The last yoga is called bhakti. The bhakti means to share, to connect. It's a verbal root that takes you back to food words. Bhaj is to eat. An ordinary place to eat in North India is called a bhojanali. Right? It's the same verbal root, right? But bhakti means something, it's usually translated love or devotion. And in there, that's a good place to kind of get your first bearings. Because you would say, I could do this, I might do this, what are the implications of that? I'm entangled in that. Then I study the kind of knowledge issues. What does that mean? How do I understand that? That becomes knowledge yoga. And then you run into that more interesting question. What would you do for love? In what way is love the reason that trumps all other reasons you have? Because you'll do things for love that don't make sense, that you don't fully understand, right? Or the implications of which you are willing to accept. right? If your children were hungry and you were broke, you would steal a loaf of bread, right? So the idea is, what would you do? And you know it's wrong, obviously. But what would you do for love? It's the first part of bhakti. The second part of bhakti is to connect it, integrate this yoga to all the other senses of yoga, of connection, of yoking. And the idea is, you become that to which you commit. What you care about is who you really are. You can say people are what they do, and you can say people are as much as they are capable of understanding themselves, that is karma and jnana, but you find out the metal of people. You find out what they're really about when you find out that what they do and what they know comes through how they care about it. Make this real practical and simple for yourself. When you find yourself not the priority in somebody else's life, that's a good indication of where their bhakti lies. Bhakti is, I care. And if you care, you're going to act a certain way, you're going to know a certain way, but the depth of your concern and care is bhakti yoga. And what he's telling you is, that's what you have to... So bhakti becomes a feeling, bhakti becomes an understanding, bhakti becomes a project of doing, right? It can be easily kind of simplistically reduced to devotion. But what it really means is you must take care, because if you don't, the world becomes transactional, it becomes mechanistic, it becomes just knowing. Like, you need the materials in Oppenheimer's argument to make the bomb. You need the knowledge to be able to build, you know, to make this thing do what it does. But you need to care about why we're doing it, or if it's legitimate, or what it means. And that's bhakti. These are the three yogas of the Bhagavad Gita. Action, knowledge, and commitment. What he's essentially asking us to do is understand that when you hear his voice, that's your voice. Be yourself and listen to me. He ends up telling us why. Because when you listen to me, you're listening to the better part of yourself. You're listening to who you are, who you can be, and I'm telling you who you could be. That will take us to, you could be a good person. You could make a change in the world. You could make a difference that makes a difference. You could create a life that engages fully, so fully that you get your own portion. You Bhagavad, right? You possess your own share of a life, and life becomes more like a song than like a task or a burden or just something you're going to get through. As Whitman said, sing the body electric, right? And sing the song of self. And when you do, make sure you include everybody else in the story. Read the Gita 1,000 times. When you're done reading it 1,000 times, read it 1,008 more times, okay? And then if you keep doing it for the next 33 years, you can send me a postcard. Tell me what you think. Have a great holiday. Be safe out there. I know you got a lot of school ahead of you before you leave. Come back. I'll see you Tuesday after Thanksgiving, because this is the last day before Thanksgiving week. Thanks so much.